Ohea oko eko ka aha. Inahe kuliana imua okea aha. Ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano. O ka moku aina o Hawaii. I naui mai, I maliu mai, I lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCAP-19714, State of Hawaii versus Moon. Arguing for the appellant, Emmanuel G. Guerrero. Arguing for the appellee, Chad M. Kumagai, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon and aloha. This proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. During the proceeding, if a justice has a question, they'll raise their hands virtually and I'll call upon them at the earliest opportunity. I'll ask our attorneys to introduce themselves in the order in which they will be arguing.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, Associate Justices Emmanuel Guerrero on behalf of Appellant Dai Han Moon.
Thank you, Mr. Guerrero.
May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Chad Kumagai for State of Hawaii, the respondent.
Thank you, Mr. Kumagai. Just to confirm, Mr. Guerrero, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning light after 25 minutes of your argument. Mr. Kumagai, you've asked for a 5 minute warning, so we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument. And at the end of each of your allotted times, you'll see a light and hear a bell to signal that you've come to the end of your 30 minutes. Mr. Guerrero, please proceed.
Thank you very much. On December 25th, Christmas Day, on that particular day of 2016, in this particular case, the decedent, Stephen Feliciano, was shot. On December 26th, the following day, on the same day, investigation occurred and eventually Dai Han Moon was arrested. On December 29th, so 3 days, 4 days later, December 29th, the state obtained an indictment charging appellant with murder in the second degree in count one, and in count three, with the use of a firearm in the commission of another felony, which is the murder in this case. That's on December 29th. They presented grand jury testimony from Dr. Happy, indicating that, well, they presented evidence that it was the appellant who shot the decedent, and that is what caused his death. That's the allegations and that's the testimony by Dr. Happy. But the thing about it is this, Dr. Happy actually said, as of December 29th, he was alive. He was not dead. Or in Hawaii, we would say, is he maki dai dead? The legal term and the legal definition of death, he did not meet it. Dr. Happy himself, the state's witness himself, said he is alive. Now, this court has two similar type of cases. That the first, the Abella case, which the court already issued a decision, and the pending case of State versus Angie regarding the issue of the definition of death in the Hawaii Penal Code. Well, first and foremost, we all know that to be convicted of a crime in the state of Hawaii, it is based upon the code, the statutory code. And in this case, the greatest offense that you can be convicted of is murder. And one of the elements of murder is the person is dead. Now, the statute 707 does not define death, but 327 does. 327 is clear on its face. If you take a look at the statute itself on 327, it applies. Death requires the opinion, written opinion of two doctors or two separate doctors, indicating that that person no longer exists to exist. It applies in criminal cases because the statute tells us it does. Now,
Mr. Guerrero, we have a question from Justice McKenna.
Okay.
Justice McKenna.
Thank you. Mr. Guerrero, I understand your arguments, but I have this question. Let's say that witnesses see someone push someone off a cliff into the ocean, and the body is never retrieved. Based on your argument, you are arguing that that person that everybody saw push someone off a cliff into the ocean could never be charged or convicted of murder because no doctor can make the determination under 327C-1.
Justice McKenna, that is not what I'm saying. What I am saying is this. The testimony presented to the grand jury was that Feliciano was alive. Now, I am fully aware that it happens all the time when the body is not located. State versus Torres, the Pearl Harbor sentry shooting, where the body was never found. But the distinguishable facts in those cases, we have a body. We have a body for the doctors to make an examination. In those cases, and I'm not going to try to speculate as to the proof that the amount of proof that the state may present, it's clearly distinguishable in this case. There is a body. The evidence was recovered. The corpus delicti was there. And Dr. Happy said he was alive. So we have a fact here presented before the grand jury that this person was alive. Not that this person was missing, not that 10 individuals saw appellant shoot this individual, chop off his body like Sopranos and buried him somewhere, or put some rocks on him on the body and drop him in the ocean. That's not the case that we have here.
So it is your position that despite the language of 327C1 subsection D, that all death determinations in the state shall be made pursuant to this section and shall apply to all purposes, including but not limited to civil and criminal actions. You're saying that because of this language, this statute applies also to 701, chapter 707 murder charges. But you're saying that there, even though there's no distinction in this statute, we should then only apply it to cases in which there is a body.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, Your Honor. And with respect to this issue that we have in this case, it's a motion for arrest of judgment because the grand jury proceedings made it clear that Feliciano was alive. Dr. Happy testified he was alive. Since Dr. Happy testified that he was alive, could I be charged with the indictment is faulty to begin with? He's not there.
Mr. Guerrero, we have a question from Justice Nakayama and then I believe Justice Edens.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Guerrero, in your own words, you said a person cannot be convicted of murder unless the person has been pronounced dead. Well, isn't it, he did go to trial. And by the time the trial, as a matter of fact, the day after the grand jury, I believe he was pronounced dead. So at the time of the trial, he was pronounced dead. So in your own words, when you said he cannot be convicted unless the victim has died, the victim had died by the time he was convicted. So why doesn't the conviction stand?
He was charged with murder on December 29th. The state presented their evidence in the grand jury. In the grand jury, it's just the state. It's just the prosecutor bringing their witnesses. And as a matter of fact, you see Dr. Happy just testified on his own with respect to what another doctor may have said in terms of Feliciano's condition. But Dr. Happy said he was alive. That's the difference in this case. They didn't have proof. They did not make out a prima facie case at the time that the indictment was issued that supports the charge of murder in the second degree. Now, if you look at the timeline, December 29th, they get the indictment. Certainly, once they had proof from the Legacy of Life on the following day, when Legacy of Life told the morgue to come and pick up the body, the state simply could have gone back to the grand jury and get a superseding indictment. You cannot just simply get the result. You have to follow the process. Due process requires that, in this case, a charge was elected and made by the state. And there's no one there challenging their evidence. No one there challenging anything. And that's what they elected to do. I'm not going to say...
Why isn't it moot after a jury convicts him of murder, after the victim actually dies, and then the jury convicts Mr. Moon of murder? Why is not the issue of whether or not he was alive at the time of the grand jury, why is that not moot at that point?
Murder is the greatest offense that we have in Hawaii, next to a murder of a law enforcement officer. The state cites In re Do for the proposition that it is moot. The court does have the authority to make a determination if, in fact, unusual circumstances warrants a review of the motion that we're the petition that we're doing now. Unusual circumstances did exist in this case. It was unusual because Dr. Happy just went up there and said, yeah, Dr. Happy said he's alive. I don't know how you can say at this point that, oh, they charge him wrong, but the result was right after the fact. So.
Okay. Mr. Guerrero, we have questions from Justice Edens and Justice Wilson. Justice Edens.
Mr. Guerrero, I'm hearing you argue that, you know, when life support is involved, 327C, compliance showing brain death before the removal of life support is the only way, the only avenue to prove a result of Mr. Moon's conduct was death. But, you know, doesn't this approach ignore the fact that Mr. Feliciano, in a real sense, was dead? I mean, I look at the evidence presented at trial, exhibits 173, 74, 176, 178. That's a picture of Mr. Feliciano's brain during the autopsy. You also have evidence of the gunshot wound to the back of the head. In fact, part of the muzzle, you know, was against the back of his head. You have all the other argument. So it's kind of hard to argue, I think, that Mr. Feliciano is not dead. Aren't there other ways that the prosecution can prove death besides a doctor's determination to terminate life support?
Well, the statute is clear on its face. If you take a look at the Legislative Reference Bureau's reports, it makes it clear that they needed to at least have a definition of death. And it applies, they made it very clear, it applies in both civil and criminal.
Well, Mr. Guerrero, doesn't that legislative report touch on the Quinlan case from the mid-70s? And isn't it with respect to civil and criminal liability geared towards protecting physicians from civil and criminal liability?
Well, it certainly does protect the doctors from potential liability, but the legislatures, when they enacted the statute, they made it very clear it applies both to criminal. Now, when you take a look at the criminal statute, there is no definition of death. So you have to take a look at 327. They could have done something about it. They could have said, hey, you know what? It doesn't apply in certain circumstances, because certainly we know that because they made the exception, changing the 1 year, 1 day missing rule.
Well, let me just ask you this. You're suggesting that all encompassing subsection D applies to all civil and all criminal cases. And I'm wondering, you know, about the implications of your position on civil wrongful death actions. Are you saying that when a victim of a fatal assault or a fatal shooting, such as this particular case, when they're placed on life support and they're subsequently removed from the life support, that there's only a viable wrongful death action if the plaintiff can show that death was determined in accordance with 327C1B? That seems to be the logical implication of your reading of this statute. Effectively, the logical extension is to foreclose wrongful death suits under those situations, unless there's a death determination under 327C1B. Can you explain that?
Justice Eddings, I'm not going to go that far since I'm unfamiliar with the civil part. But in terms of a criminal case,
well, I'll clarify it for you then. If you're saying that that's the only way death can be determined and it applies to all civil and all criminal actions, then why wouldn't it apply to wrongful death actions?
I wouldn't be able to give you an answer to that, Justice Eddings. All I can tell you is when you look at the statute and the way it's worded and the way it's made clear, it applies in criminal case. And in this particular case, keep in mind, we're challenging the grand jury, where the state elected within 3 to 4 days to charge murder in the second degree, when they knew at that point that the person was still alive.
I understand that. I'll have one last point here, Mr. Guerrero. You're not arguing that the charging document itself, the indictment, did not allege all the elements and provide notice to your client, right? You're just talking about the probable cause determination. You have no problem with the way the indictment provided notice to your client, right?
Well, if it was in fact murder, yeah. But we do know, in fact, that the facts that came out is that he should have been charged with something else, not murder. So we do have a problem with the indictment being charged as murder when the facts presented does not support it. And that's an unusual circumstance that should allow the court to exercise review. And I don't know how we can get around the fact that the state has a responsibility of prosecuting. They did what they did in a manner which is so quick, without looking at all of the facts, presenting it, and then when they became aware, 1 day after the indictment, when they became aware that somehow the person is now they have the proof of death, they elect not to do anything. They don't elect to do a superseding indictment. They don't elect to modify the charge somehow. It's December 30th. The grand jury is still there.
I'm sorry, I thought I was done, but one other thing, as far as electing not to do things, the defense elected not to file a motion to dismiss as part of trial strategy. Is that correct?
I was not part of the trial team in this case. As the court is well aware, he had a private counsel first, and then trial counsel was also private counsel, but was different counsel. I I came in after the fact on the appeal, and they did raise that issue after trial within 10 days of the judgment. So it's our position that the indictment, the grand jury was faulty to begin with.
Mr. Guerrero, we have a question from Justice Wilson. Thank you.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Guerrero, I also wanted to ask you a question about the applicability of this 327C1 provision B that seems to apply to a certain factual situation. Now, there's an implication, I guess, that the factual situation that it doesn't apply to is the one that we have in this case, where you've got somebody that's on artificial life support that has their organs harvested. So with respect to the proposition that actually the legislature intended for this specific statute to apply to those who are being declared dead after they've been placed on artificial means of support, let me ask you about the factual scenario in this case and whether this would be just the kind of scenario that the legislature intended to try to address. Because in this case, unless I'm not correct about the facts, the decedent wasn't the decedent when he came to the hospital. When he came to the hospital, he was clearly alive, right? He had spontaneous circulation. And after he had spontaneous circulation, some days later, for the first time, he comes in on the 25th of December, and then for the first time, 3 days later, the investigator notices that he's on artificial means, the medical investigator. That's Christopher Noe. But that's the first time that there is an indication that he's on artificial means. And it's before that that he's declared brain dead, not in accordance with the statute, not in accordance with the statement, but nonetheless declared brain dead by Dr. Nakagawa. And it's not clear that he was even on life support at that time. So I guess the point I'm making is there an issue here about the extent to which he actually was alive? When he comes in alive, and a police officer incidentally sees him 2 days later and says he's unresponsive, but doesn't say he's on artificial means of support. The day after that, the doctor sees him and says he's dead, but doesn't say he's on artificial means of support. And finally, the investigator sees him on artificial means of support. There's no determination of death after that until after, I mean, of course he's dead after there's an autopsy, but there's no determination of death until the autopsy takes place. And during the course of the testimony of the doctor that did the autopsy, he says that there isn't damage to the brainstem from the bullet. So, I mean, I'm suggesting that the flavor of the evidence is such that its lack of clarity would suggest that the issue of whether he's alive or not is at stake here. But that issue would be addressed under 327C1B, right, if that process had been followed, because then you would have had a determination of whether not only was he brain dead. The doctor never said, in accordance with the statute, that he was brain dead and it was irreversible, an irreversible cessation of brain activity, just said he was brain dead. But if the statute was complied with, then you'd have a determination that his brain death was irreversible. And in addition to that, you'd have some indication the statute was followed when it said that there's supposed to be a determination of brain death before the organs are harvested, or before he's taken off life support. So isn't this the kind of situation that the legislature sought to address?
Yes, I think when you take a look at the LRB, that is what that is one of the reasons why they did it.
At the LRB, my understanding of the LRB's report, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, is there's an extensive discussion about criminal cases.
Yep.
there's a, you've got the Lyons case, the Saldana case from California, in which the very issue of death with respect to the use of artificial means of support is discussed. There's a long discussion about the old English case in which there was a bar fight, and then the victim of the bar fight had his liver harvested, and it was unclear from the point of view of the experts whether he was dead at the time. I mean, it just seemed that that was a major focus of this report.
Precisely, and they even cite Kate. They even stated specifically that there were cases where a person is in life support and the life support was taken away, and the charge eventually became something other than homicide, simply because of the issue of life or death. And that is the point that we're trying to make here. And you take a look, the LRB expands 101 pages, at least, from my count. Well, I'm sorry, 186 pages. 186 pages, and it talks about what Your Honor is just talking about as I'm talking. But at the end, they made it clear, if you have the body, at least in this context, if you have the body, it applies in a criminal case as to the time of death.
Or did it Mr. Guerrero, if you don't have the body, is there an issue about the person having their organs harvested and being on a means of artificial support? I mean, I'm not sure how necessary it is to go through the analysis of somebody whose body is hidden by a suspect, a defendant, when we're talking about a specific factual situation here that involves somebody whose organs are being harvested when they're on artificial support. And if you would like to, I'm going to ask Mr. Kumagai this, but how do you apply 327C1 to criminal cases? And I'm not sure how you could interpret this statute to say it's not supposed to apply somehow to criminal cases, because there's a specific provision that says it applies. But how do you come to the conclusion it doesn't apply to criminal cases? What is the analysis that you think is used either by the intermediate court or was used by the opposition in this case? Help me with that. How does it not apply?
Mr. Guerrero, can you hear the question?
I'm sorry.
That was a question to you.
Oh. I thought I heard Chad Kumagai's name somewhere along the line.
Well, I just said I'm going to ask him a similar question, so I thought I might as well see what your response is.
Okay, I'm sorry, Justice Wilson. I kind of lost track as to what the exact question was.
Well, that's okay. I mean, I'm sorry if you lost me, and I'll just save the time to ask Mr. Kumagai, and maybe if you want to, you can address it on rebuttal. We'll see.
Okay. And Guerrero, anything else at this time, or do you want to reserve your time for rebuttal?
At this point, I'll do 1 minute. I think at least the issue at the trial level, I think the court should consider the issue of the instruction of whether causation should have been instructed. Abella and Angie, it tells us that it should have been, at least. There wasn't, not saying that there was an intervening cause.
Yeah, Mr. Guerrero, in Abella, there was evidence that the decedent was improving, was responding better to stimuli. Was there any such evidence here to indicate that the gunshot wound to the head was not the cause of death?
Well, it's Dr. Happy himself who testified that he's alive. And at least we know he's alive from December 25th to 26th, 27th, 28th, even the 29th. We know that on the 30th, even without the two written opinions by the doctors, we know Feliciano was no longer with us because he was in the morgue. But we do know that there was a 4-5 day period that he was alive. So we don't know if there was an intervening cause, but we do know that he was alive, which strongly suggests in the Abella case and in the Angie case, which I understand is still pending cert, if there's a possible intervening cause, it should be, the court should provide that instruction. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Guerrero. Mr. Kumagai, your argument.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Chad Kumagai for Respondent State of Hawaii. Your Honors, at issue in this proceeding is HRS 327C-1, which, if petitioner's argument is correct, has gone undiscovered by every prosecutor, every criminal defense attorney, every court for nearly 40 years. And it's easy to see why, given the placement and the content of the statute. 327C-1 is nowhere in the penal code. Unlike other examples in the penal code itself, it's not referenced in HRS 707-700. The statute is not written in an exhaustive manner for a definition of death. It merely provides two conditions under which a person shall be considered dead. Under my reading of the statute does not even use the word definition. Unlike every other definition in the penal code, the statute provides a procedure rather than merely a definition, as with every other definition in the code. This, in addition to the legislative history surrounding the statute, clearly indicates that the statute applies to physicians, and it was meant to shield them from civil and criminal liability in order to give them the ability to determine death without risk of a wrongful death suit or criminal prosecution. It was never intended to apply to non-physician defendants. And speaking of that legislative history, Your Honors, I think it is important to look at the Legislative Research Bureau towards determination of death materials. And I think it's instructive that this wave of statutes across the country started with two cases, well, at least one case and a second case in Hawaii that had nothing to do with criminal, non-physician criminal liability, the Karen Ann Quinlan case and the Alice Cameron case. With respect to the Quinlan case, Ms. Quinlan was in a vegetative state because she consumed Valium and gin and tonic at a party. Her father sued for authorization for the doctors to discontinue her respirator and enjoined the prosecutor from charging him with homicide. In the Alice Cameron case, she allegedly swallowed cocaine encased in condoms. So, Your Honors, the genesis of these statutes has nothing to do with non-physician criminal liability. And further, throughout the entire report, there are numerous references to physicians' concern with civil and criminal liability for their actions. With respect,
Kumagai, if you could you address the circumstances that existed at the time of the grand jury where there was still life support? Dr. Happy testified that the decedent was being kept alive on life support. So, you know, at that point in time, there was some uncertainty as to the determination of death under traditional, you know, sort of circulatory breathing definitions. So why not apply the statute in that narrow context?
Your Honor, thank you for that question. I first like to clarify that the decedent wasn't alive in the sense that all of us on this Zoom meeting are. The decedent was being kept artificially alive so that his organs could be donated. But he had been declared brain dead. So, and I think that when a person is declared brain dead, their respiratory and circulatory systems are necessarily lack spontaneous function.
I thought his brainstem had not been injured.
His brainstem had not been injured, but as Dr. Happy testified in the grand jury, he had been declared brain dead. Under a, I guess, non-statutory definition of death, Mr. Feliciano arguably was dead. And there was
your view is the statute has no applicability at all, even despite the somewhat the sort of at least somewhat conflicting status or some, you know, somewhat complex status that the that Mr. Feliciano was in at that time. No relevance at all. Is that just that, or is there some, or should it be a guide in these kinds of circumstances, at least in the kinds of circumstances that existed at the time of the grand jury proceeding?
It's my position that yes, this statute has no applicability as it relates to non-physician defendants, given the legislative history of the statute. And I think, and the fact that the legislature has at least implicitly indicated its intent that this statute should not apply to non-physician defendants, because for the last 40 years, the legislature has not amended the statute or passed a resolution in any way that would indicate that the prosecutors and criminal defense attorneys doing homicide cases had got it all wrong this whole time. I think had there been a intention by the legislature for this statute to apply in a case like this, it would have made it clear, and it would have been the statute would have been referenced in the penal code as a definition of death.
So what's the reference to criminal liability in your mind?
The reference to criminal liability. Sorry, I'm sorry.
So the statute refers to all purposes, civil and criminal, all proceedings. What is the reference to criminal proceedings in your from your point of view?
From my point of view, that reference is to insulate physicians from civil and criminal liability as a result of their actions in determining death and allowing the removal of organs or anything other adjacent to death, including probate, burials, criminal prosecutions, well, not criminal prosecutions for non-physician defendants, but you know, there was a discussion of criminal cases in the LRB reference material. However, I think that there's an important distinction to be made. The statute before the court provides a procedure for determining death. The cases that are cited in the LRB provide a definition of death. And I think that's a real qualitative difference. On one hand, the cases referenced in the LRB say, for example, that a person is dead if they are brain dead. Our statute goes farther and provides specific criteria for, I guess, determining death. And that's really unprecedented in the penal code and a main distinction between the statute before the court now and the cases that were referenced in the legislative materials.
Justice Wilson has a question, Mr. Kumagai. Justice Wilson.
Thank you, CJ. Thank you, Mr. Kumagai. I am interested in getting your analysis and a little bit more clarified with respect to this idea that the report that was prepared called Towards a Definition of Death, which has very clear language that they're looking, the legislature wants guidance, broadly speaking, on civil and criminal cases. A report that concludes with a statute that says that the determination in the statute is supposed to be applied to civil and criminal cases. Your view is that we should interpret the legislative history to mean it was just for physicians. And so from that point of view, we should exclude all other citizens accused of murder in a case in which there's a question of an intervening cause of death that arises from the decedent being placed on artificial means of support. The protections of 327C1B with this legislative history is supposed to apply only to physicians. And if that's correct, I don't see how you can square that with language such as in the report, it says The questions of timing and cause of death often arose where the homicide victim was on artificial life support, and noted that a court will generally rule against the original assailant if it accepts that a person is legally dead upon a declaration of brain death. This isn't specific to physicians. Then the cases that are cited in support of that proposition also don't apply to physicians. So how you come to the conclusion that this is a physician determination of death in criminal cases still escapes me. So if you want to cite language in this long report where the legislature says it's only supposed to apply to physicians, I would find that to be very helpful. And also, you know, you usually use the term brain death. This is a statute that doesn't just refer to brain death. It says it has to be irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain. So this particular specific definition of death, again, you say it only applies in criminal cases against doctors. I don't see the rationale in the report, and I don't see the rationale from the cases that are cited to say that we're going to apply this very specific definition of brain death only to physicians. So if you could help me with that, where is the language in the legislative report that says it's only to be for physicians, or the language in this statute, which on its face doesn't seem to be a physician's death statute?
Well, Your Honor, the report that you're referring to makes numerous references to physician liability and their concern regarding death and civil liability.
But if you use that analysis, I'm sorry to interrupt you, can't you apply it the same way with respect to the discussion that is discussing how the definition of death should apply in homicide cases? You're saying part of the discussion has to do with physicians, so we should conclude that that's the entire purpose of the legislative report.
It's not just part of the report, Your Honor. It's in multiple places in the report. For example, the homicide section in the report says experience indicates that whether a homicide victim is used as a transplant donor, the physician exposes himself to additional criminal and civil and criminal sanctions while sometimes releasing the original assailant from responsibility. It also says a physician who removed a brain dead patient from artificial life support systems expose himself to criminal liability for homicide or civil liability for wrongful death or both. The Senate Journal in 1978, in which the year that this bill was passed, also contains a quote from Governor Ariyoshi when he decided to sign the bill, where he says, many doctors feel that with a precise definition of death, they would be less vulnerable to malpractice suits. In addition, the Tucker Administrator v. Lower case discussed in the homicide section of the report was a proceeding against a doctor where the brother of a transplant donor sued for surgeon for the wrongful death of the donor. And this is precisely.
All right. Let's just assume that that's the language that we focus on, and we don't focus on the other discussion about homicide cases generally. How can we make that the public policy that the legislature intended in terms of why would it only apply to doctors? Why do they get the benefit of this definition as opposed to, like in this case, for example, the defendant Moon, who is saying, you know, the definition is important for the same reasons it's important to doctors. That is to make sure that the persons whose organs have been harvested aren't losing their life because of the actions of a doctor as opposed to the actions of Mr. Moon.
You know, the way that this court can get over the language of the statute, if it feels that it needs to do so, is by looking at the legislative history that I've cited. And this court has held that even where the plain language of the statute is clear upon perfunctory review, it can still look to legislative aids to divine the true intent of the legislature. That's State v. McKnight, State v. DeMello, State v. Abel, State v. Nickel. And so, Your Honor, the bill itself is written in a way that is directed only to physicians. Sections A and B direct physicians to undertake a certain procedure. Subsection E provides a review process for physicians. So I think it's a stretch to say that D applies to anything other than physicians. And I think it's even more of a stretch to believe that the legislature had intended this statute to apply to non-physician defendants, yet sat silent for 40 years without any amendment or resolution or any indication that the prosecution was doing this wrong the whole time.
Mr. Kumagaya, we have questions from Justice McKenna and then Justice Edens.
Mr. Kumagaya, kind of following up on Justice Wilson's questions. First of all, the report itself is not necessarily legislative intent, correct?
Yes.
And the report actually has suggested statutory language, but there's one clause that appears to be really different than what the report suggested and what's in what was actually passed. The report in subsection C talked about, when a part of a donor is used for direct transplantation under chapter 327, and the donor's death is established by determining, irreversible cessation of brain function, the determination shall only be made under subsection B of this section. But the actual statute added the next sentence. The determination of death in all other cases shall be made under subsection A, which led to my question to Mr. Guerrero. Subsection A says that when it's not an organ transplantation situation, to determine death, you have to have two doctors attesting to death. How do you get that without a body? Even though you see the person being killed, but you can't find the body, and there's no doctor to establish death pursuant to subsection A, how can you then say that this does apply to all murder cases, which subsection D says it applies to all criminal cases? So therefore, it does appear that we do need to look at the legislative history of this statute.
Thank you, Justice McKenna. I believe that strict application of the plain language of this statute, as the petitioner is arguing, would lead to that precise absurd result, that when a body cannot be located, or even if a mere skeleton or just part of a body is discovered, that there would be no way to comply with this statute. And the specificity in that statute, I think, prevents any inference that a person could be determined dead if the statute applies. And that, I think, is surely an absurd result that the legislature did not intend. I think there's also other absurd results, such as a chilling effect on organ donation. And so these absurd results can be used to overcome the plain language of the statute. I think, Justice Edens, you also have a question.
Justice Edens, your question.
Mr. Kumagai, we all know that, grand juries, they listen to evidence, they weigh sometimes competing evidence, they draw inferences from the evidence, and they make a call on whether elements are proven or not. In this case, Dr. Happy, it could be viewed as talking out of two sides of his mouth, but really the jury did look at the evidence and say that probable cause was shown, okay? But let's say perhaps that there were defects in the probable cause determination. It lacked probable cause to support the element before the grand jury of death. The charging document, however, is correct. It alleges all the elements. It provides notice to the defendant here. We go through a trial. There's no pretrial motion to dismiss. The jury concludes that all elements have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Now we get to your position. Can you explain your position that if There is a lack of a probable cause determination supporting the indictment, that deficiency is cured by proof of all elements of the crime. Can you explain how you get there? And I know you cited In re Doe. In my view, that case is a little bit different because that's a pretrial detention situation with probable cause. But tell me how, and this sort of gets to the point that Justice Nakayama talked about a little while ago with Mr. Guerrero, the Moot issue. Can you explain that and your analysis there?
Well, I think that the In re Doe rule, and well, specifically the rule that conviction by a petit jury renders moot any deficiency in a grand jury proceeding is common sense, because the petit jury is going to consider the evidence presented to it under a higher standard, the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. So if the state can satisfy that standard, I think it is moot that the state, assuming arguendo, could not satisfy a probable cause standard. And I think that under that stricter standard, it just makes sense that the lack of probable cause would be moot.
And another question, it sort of relates to the question the Chief Justice was asking Mr. Guerrero. Was there any evidentiary support to give an intervening cause jury instruction? Obviously, it's the court's responsibility to provide jury instructions. So the fact that nobody asked for it doesn't matter, but there has to be evidentiary support. Was there any evidentiary support here to give an intervening cause jury instruction? That was the last point that Mr. Guerrero raised. He said, hey, look, all these arguments going, well, why didn't I get my intervening cause jury instruction? Was there any evidentiary support?
My position is that there was no evidentiary support that would have required that causation instruction. This case is entirely distinguishable from Abella. In Abella, the decedent had indicia. There was indicia that the decedent was improving. He could wiggle his toes. He could respond to stimuli in his eyes. But I think more than that, the critical fact that distinguishes this case and negates the need for any intervening cause instruction is that nobody made the decision to withhold life support. And I think that would have been the intervening, or possibly the intervening cause in Abella. There's no such indication that that happened here. So, Your Honors, unless the court has any other questions, thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I ask that you rule in favor of the respondent.
Mr. Kumagai, how do you read Section A? So in your view, Section A is it's a situation where there isn't somebody on life support, and in your view, would Section A be applicable to the situation of the missing body case, or is that kind of the absurd result that you would see in that case where they're required to have medical testimony?
Your Honor, I think there still would be an absurd result because of the specific procedures that are in subsection A and throughout the statute. So, as I said earlier, I don't believe that the requirements of the statute could be inferred because of the specificity of the requirements. So again, I think that application of this statute would produce an absurd result.
What is the purpose of subsection A? Why is it there? In other words, if the statute is all about taking people off of life support, why do we need A, or what does A accomplish?
I believe it's for non-organ donation situations. If someone is, I don't know, maintained on life support, but the spontaneous circulatory and respiratory functions of that person are no longer present, then that they can be declared dead. And I think more importantly, there is a time of death. And that's really a distinction between the medical definition of death versus the legal definition of death. And the report that we've talked about today discusses that, that medically death is a process where each organ shuts down one by one, biological cells start to die. But legally, it is important to have a specific time of death to trigger all of the things that are adjacent to death and that must be done after a person has died. So in a lot of ways, I think that can be viewed as the real purpose of the statute, to provide a specific time of death.
All right, Justice Wilson.
Thank you. Just to be clear, Mr. Kumagai, Section A, in your view, only applies to doctors, only applies to actions against doctors.
Yes, because I think that Section A, B, and C provide assurances to a doctor that a person is dead and that the things adjacent to death can begin. And the doctors don't need to worry about civil or criminal liability as a result of actions that are taken after the person has expired.
Would you concede that part of the purpose of the legislative history was to make sure that people are actually brain dead from the point of view of irreversible cessation of all functions of the brain, to make sure that they are dead before their organs are harvested?
If you're referring to sections B and C, Your Honor, I do think that is the purpose.
Okay, but you don't think that that purpose is of significance to the legislature, according to the legislative intent, sufficiently that it would also apply to non-physician defendants in civil and criminal cases?
No, Your Honor, I think just the opposite. I think the legislative history is clear that the statute only applies to physicians.
So from that point of view, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's your sense that the legislature didn't really feel there was a problem with respect to civil and criminal cases that are being brought against the ordinary citizens. That same concern wouldn't apply there?
I feel that the legislature intended for wrongful death actions and criminal prosecutions and homicide cases to continue as they were before. I think that looking at the legislative history and the procedural history leading up to the statute, it's clear that the only thing that was changed is physician liability. Okay.
When you say as proceed from before, I assume you're saying that the legislature felt comfortable with the way that death determinations were being found prior to the passage of 327C1A, and they preferred that even given the advent of artificial means of support, they felt that it was best to just continue the same type of death determinations that occurred prior to 327C1's passage, at least with respect to citizens that weren't physicians.
Your Honor, what I was referring to is the two cases that I mentioned earlier, the Karen Ann Quinlan case and the Alice Cameron case, which really inform the purpose of this statute and the...
Yeah, I see your point. You think that that's what informed the legislature as opposed to the discussion about homicides broadly. I see that point, but I'm just trying to be clear that there is this distinction that you felt the legislature meant to preserve between the way that death is proven where you have a doctor defendant versus a normal citizen.
Yes.
And where you're involving artificial means of support.
Yes, I think the legislature did not mean to disturb any civil or criminal actions against non-physician defendants because, again, if that were the case, I believe that the legislature would have done something or said something to indicate that it wanted to do so. It would have been a simple fix to reference this statute in 707-700 or pass a resolution that called for this burden of proof pursuant to the statute.
Perhaps. Maybe it would have been just as easy for them to say at some point that this is a statute that applies just to doctors.
Yes, but
in the statute, they clearly didn't do that.
But yes, but the fact that everything had been proceeding as it was before the statute was enacted, I think speaks greater volumes as to the legislature's intent. So thank you, Your Honor, for the time. I ask that you rule in favor of respondent State of Hawaii.
I just had one last question, Mr. Kumagai. Again, yes, coming back to the question I asked earlier, you know, subsection B, in your view, has no application whatsoever in the circumstances of this case, even in the grand jury. I mean, isn't there a sense in which, given perhaps some uncertainty or differences of views in the medical community about what when someone might be considered dead or what the criteria might be, that this statute provides guidance that should be available, and that we'll be precluding it from being available to the state and to others in determining whether to go forward with organ donation or face the possibility of there being a dispute about whether the person was in fact dead?
Your Honor, I believe that if there was a dispute as to whether a person is dead in a particular case, I think that the courts could use a common understanding of death as it does for all non-defined terms in the penal code. And that would allow both parties to provide expert testimony or any other sort of evidence that could suggest that a person was or wasn't dead. I think with this rigid requirements of this statute, we're essentially stuck in 1978. And I think it's good policy to allow the parties to argue with experts whether or not a person is dead, because they would be able to testify as to modern medical technology, modern medical trends, and that would be a better determinant of whether a person is dead. Thank you.
Very well, thank you. Mr. Guerrero, your rebuttal. Mr. Guerrero, you're on mute. Sorry about that.
My apologies, Chief Justice. As a closing note, I've heard that what I've been hearing is, what is the intentions of the legislatures? What was their purpose? Why would they put the definition of death here? What I didn't hear is that is what the legislature stated. It's about as clear as the light of day. It applies in all civil and criminal proceedings. I don't know how you can get around that. Addressing Justice Nakayama's and as well as the prosecuting attorney's response that then you can't prove death if there's no body. Again, in this case, we have a body, and the application for transfer was very specific, that the grand jury proceedings was defective to begin with. First, because of the proof, failure to comply with 327, and more specifically, the proof at the grand jury is that he was alive. And the statute makes it clear. He was not dead. He was not determined to be dead. 327 is clear. And unless there's anything else, I want to thank the court for the opportunity to be heard.
All right. Well, thank you to both of our counsel for your arguments here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Ua ho'oku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolokolo ki'e hanohano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.